Hello and welcome to the After Dinner Podcast. My name is Jay Swords. This is the podcast extension for ROI Show 555. Our guest today is Dr. Andrew Granville, Distinguished Research Chair in Pure Mathematics at the Mathematical Research Center in Montreal. We're talking about his article, Why Mathematical Proof is a Social Compact. Our history buffs today are Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. Ed, start us off this time.
Thanks, Jay. Andrew, you mentioned earlier in the show that I guess you self-described as a skeptic of technology in general, but particularly of AI. And I think of technology through time, I mean, going all the way back as a hunter-gatherer, you could pick up a stick and I can either hit you over the head with it or I can spear some sort of animal to provide food. And almost every form of technology since then has been that, has had two sides to that coin. You can use it for good or for bad. Can you tell us your view on, in that vein, about what your expectations are of AI?
Oh my! Well, it's a very dangerous future, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you've been reading about this OpenAI company, which is leading a lot of her research, and the CEO got fired one minute, got reinstated the next. Now he wants to raise $7 trillion so he can solve the world's problems. But that means they're going to have to, do military AI in order to raise that kind of money. You just sit there thinking, oh my God, so the world's largest AI company is going to do military stuff. And what does that mean? But of course, every country is going to try and have military applications for AI. It's a brave new world. It's a frightening one, is all I can say. I don't have a prediction. I think some of our politicians have to try to get it together and rein in the big companies. And one can only hope it brings peace. I mean, I don't know. Like all new weaponry, this can be quite extreme.
There's a school of thought, and I don't know that it's philosophy or whatever, but there's a school of thought that observes that that force is, be that religious, economic, or political, military, that force is rarely used as a force for good. That power is not, consistently beneficial. Can you shine that light on AI for us?
Well, I think you have to have responsible players. Nobody is fully responsible. That's the problem, right? I mean, unfortunately, this all becomes global politics, if you like. But, my view, the U.S. has been the peacekeeper of the world for 70 years, but I don't agree with many of their policies, even if, at the end of the day, many of the right calls have been made. And, you've got to hope that whoever is the world leaders in AI, it does as well as the U.S. has done in many situations in, preserving peace and not making the bad calls, if we're lucky. So, yeah, it's a tricky one. Who knows?
Were those great questions?
the word that kept flashing through my mind, Andrew, as you were talking was Skynet, but...
Yeah,
the dystopian science fiction people seem to have a lot to say on the subject.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Of course, again, with AI, you can look at some old AI and you find, if you cherry pick it, people have been incredibly perceptive as to what's going to happen in the future. And, drones seem to be the first instance really of an unhuman warfare, and we're obviously moving very fast in that direction, aren't we, with AI?
Okay, Terry, you've been very patient waiting to ask your question. Go ahead.
Well, I do. So, yeah, Andrew, so I keep coming back to when you're talking about how do we know if we're being objective, because with math, we want to say that this statement is accepted. This part is true. This is our starting point. And then with a logical progression, logical deductions, we can make our claim. And I keep coming back to a book that I'm currently in the middle of reading called Dark Emu, where the author suggests, actually through written letters and journals and diaries, that when British colonials and adventurers came to Australia and saw the indigenous population, they automatically assumed they were hunters and gatherers because they saw what they wanted to see.
Right.
And they were in some way blinded by their own culture. So it said more about them than it did about the indigenous population. And in Dark Emu, he shows through their own letters and diaries that actually, no, they were agrarians. You know, the whole continent was agrarian. They were not hunters and gatherers. But so then makes me think, you know, because that was what I grew up with, thinking that for 70 years, realizing, oh, that was false. Okay, so how do we know about what are popular misconceptions today about proof? And how do we know if we're being objective?
We don't. We don't. We have a paradigm we work in. That's it's as simple as that. We have a paradigm we work in. And within that paradigm, we can probably judge things fairly well. But if a paradigm shifts, then all bets are off. I mean, there is a long philosophical discussion about scientific objectivity. And these points are discussed at great length. But personally, I'm a subscriber to the paradigm idea that it's all about the way we agree to perceive things. So I think, yes, your analogy is very apt, that you can look on situations and think you understand, but because you're putting it within your own framework, you may have missed the wood for the trees.
Yeah. All
right. I get the last question, Andrew, and so one of the things you talked about in your article, and I'm going to horribly mispronounce this poor guy's name, and I apologize in the at the beginning here, is it Mochizuki, who came up with an ABC conjecture, and you could maybe take 30 seconds to describe that. That'll be a nice challenge for you. But what I'm really interested in was his presentation was functionally illegible for his peers, and his comment was sort of, so what? You know, if you can't figure it out, that's on you. It's not my problem. And I've seen this happen in history as well. So what about this idea of having a responsibility as someone putting forth a new idea to make sure that it is understandable to the extent that you can do so and that it is accessible to challenge, which is what science does and mathematics does in terms of proving or disproving an idea?
Right. Well, starting off with what is the ABC conjecture? You're looking at just the equation A plus B equals C, where you're putting in whole numbers for A, B, and C. And what we're interested in is the structure of A, B, and C. So whenever you have, you know, 3 plus 7 equals 10, then, for instance, 10 is 2 times 5. So you see a bunch of, you can sort of factor all the numbers into their prime numbers. 3 is already prime, 7 is already prime, 10 is 2 times 5. And then essentially what the ABC conjecture says is that the prime numbers involved can't be to high powers. So you can't have, so let me give you an example that looks a bit like a counterexample to what I said, is 3 plus 125 is 128. So 3 plus 125 is 5 cubed, and 128 is 2 to the power 7. So that's quite an extreme example, and the claim is there's nothing much more extreme than a few simple examples. So that's a very vague description of the ABC conjecture, and there is a very precise formulation of this question. And then Mochizuki, who's known as a very brilliant man, claimed about a decade ago to have resolved it, which would have massive implications all over mathematical science. In fact, some of my work would go from being of moderate interest to being highly important. So I was on his side to be right. However, he wrote very obscurely, and he used his own language. And he, as you said, he really said, well, okay, I have a right. If it's all logical, if I build it up from incontrovertible statements at the start to a crescendo here, then it's your responsibility to read it. I don't have to translate into a language you feel comfortable with. And, you know, I mean, in some sense, he's right. We should have just logical procedures working from axioms. But he sort of entirely missed this idea of social compact, of participatory understanding. And actually, Peter Schulze in Germany, who's one of the great current mathematicians in the world, has come out and said he's sure Mochizuki is wrong. But the way he went about this was he sort of read enough of Mochizuki to get some hints as to what Mochizuki's approach is. And then he tried to construct his own approach based on Mochizuki's ideas, which is a certain arrogance, but also he's a brilliant guy, so he's allowed to be that arrogant. So he created his own approach, and he found a point at which he really felt there was no way you could jump that hurdle. And then he felt he identified the same point in Mochizuki's tangled web, and flew to Kyoto and challenged Mochizuki to explain to him. And anyway, it didn't end well. They agreed to disagree, which was a bit sad, really. But I think, to me, yes, Mochizuki's in the wrong. He's ignoring that we have a way to go about things. There's people who are asking some things about cultural aspects. There is a cultural aspect that in Japan, senior professors are treated with much more respect than they are in the U.S. And I'm not sure that's a good thing in all academic areas, because sometimes you need your colleagues to give you a hard time. And I think in this case, he could do with it. He needs to provide, if he's right, then he needs to provide something that we can agree on, at the very least. So one argument would be, well, if he could put this into an appropriate computer language, it could check the proof. And I feel everybody would be much happier if he could do that. And that would certainly go a long way to believing him. But as it stands, he's not really moving on the issues that people are concerned about. So he's just sure he's right. And I think in Japan, few people are prepared to tell the most famous mathematician in Japan that they're wrong. So that is a bit of a problem.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up. We want to thank our guest for this 555th show, Dr. Andrew Granville, Distinguished Research Chair in Pure Mathematics at the Mathematical Research Center in Montreal. We've been talking about his article, Why Mathematical Proof is a Social Compact. The History Bus for today were Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. ROI can be found at 9:30 p.m. Friday nights on KALA Radio or on the web at tunein.com. If you're looking for older programs, you can find them at soundcloud.com. Just put KALA Radio in all one word in the search, click on the first icon, and scroll down to find over a decade of ROI shows. You can also find ROI on all of your favorite streaming platforms. ROI is recorded at Station KALA, St. Ambrose University.